Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this national telebriefing to update the public on the outcomes of the Global Climate Summit in Paris and the role of nuclear power in the climate talks. I am Tim Judson, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, which is hosting the briefing. We are pleased that so many of you could be here tonight. This is our third year of providing these international briefings to provide people in the U.S. and around the world with in-depth information on urgent issues relating to nuclear power, sustainable energy, climate action, and radioactive waste. These briefings are all open to the public for anyone to attend. While we primarily invite people to attend these briefings through our email list of supporters and our followers on social media, we encourage you to spread the word to anyone you think would be interested in the topics our briefings cover. The next New Year's telebriefing will be on April 5th, with updates on the 5th and 30th anniversaries, respectively, of the nuclear disasters at Fukushima, Japan, and Chernobyl, Ukraine. The briefing will feature international nuclear safety expert Arne Gundersen and NIRS' own Mary Olson, who will report back on their trip to Japan over the anniversary of Fukushima. For those of you not familiar with NIRS, we are the primary national information and resource center for the anti-nuclear and safe energy movement in the U.S. For 36 years, we have worked, or 38 years rather, we have worked to end the use of nuclear power in the U.S. and for technically sound, environmentally just, and publicly acceptable solutions for radioactive waste. We provide support to grassroots activists and local campaigns, and we serve as a watchdog in Washington, D.C., leading campaigns on national policy issues, such as the Mobile Chernobyl bill and taxpayer subsidies to build new nuclear reactors. But to be successful, we need your support as well, both in taking action on the issues and, just as importantly, in whatever financial support you can provide to our work. If you feel NIRS's work is important, please consider making a contribution, which you can do on our website, www.nirs.org. So in December, we witnessed the first truly global agreement to address climate change. Leaders from across the world met for 2 weeks, capping off more than a year of discussions and nearly 20 years of United Nations conferences aimed at mitigating the climate crisis. And activists were there, too, organizing and mobilizing all along the way, from before the People's Climate March in New York City in 2014 all the way through the meetings in Paris. The unwritten story behind a climate agreement is how the climate movement and independent energy experts like our two guests tonight made that agreement possible. The general public and even the historians can be excused for not necessarily knowing that. The prohibition on protests of almost any kind in Paris had a stifling effect on the whole atmosphere of COP21. With barely any visible public pressure able to manifest itself inside or outside the conference, certainly nothing like the People's Climate March or the mass mobilizations that have been an important feature of the United Nations meetings on climate change, the agreement on the table just 2 days before the conference was over was widely understood to represent a major failure. But the frustration of activists boiled over in a series of unpermitted actions seemed to embolden a number of countries who pushed UN leaders for the strong climate agreement that we ended up with in the end. NIRS was there as well. We spent nearly all of 2015 working with climate action and anti-nuclear groups to build a Don't Nuke the Climate coalition. By the time of the conference, over 500 organizations from around the world had joined. But again, you wouldn't know that by the official record of the COP21 conference. That is not only because of the heavy security measures and the protest ban France instituted after the horrific November terrorist attacks. It was also because of the heavy presence of nuclear power promoters throughout the COP. They saw the climate agreement as possibly one of their final opportunities to win subsidies and incentives favoring nuclear energy at the expense of true climate solutions. While anti-nuclear groups were not allowed to have a visible presence inside the conference, industry supporters were allowed virtually unfettered access to the government delegations. They even handed out thousands of copies of a book claiming that anti-nuclear activists are causing the climate crisis. Leaders like President Obama made token appearances with companies promoting nuclear power as well. But perhaps most concerning, a group of respected climate scientists put out a similar call for nuclear power to have a central role in the climate accord. I say most concerning because of the divisiveness that message could have among environmentalists and how their recommendations could, if taken up by world leaders, impede our efforts to reduce climate change and lead to other terrible environmental and climate justice problems. In short, nuclear power is too dirty, too dangerous, too expensive, and too slow to solve the climate crisis. And we have much, much better tools to do the job right at our fingertips. Our guests tonight are among the prominent international energy experts who have actually researched the best ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and mitigate global warming. They are Mark Jacobson from Stanford University and founder of the Solutions Project, and Dr. Arjun Makajani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. They are far from alone, with more and more studies showing that it is not only possible, but faster and more feasible to replace fossil fuels and nuclear power with clean, renewable energy resources. But they are two of our best minds working on the problem, and we invited them here tonight to address this important topic. Paris and Onward, the path forward to a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future. It is in no small part due to their credit and the work of independent experts like them that we were able to keep nuclear power out of the climate agreement and to lay the groundwork for a clean energy future. In a moment, I will introduce our presenters further, but first I have a few instructions on how we will handle questions and answers and the discussion to happen after their presentation. Because of the large number of participants tonight, everyone has been muted. At the end of each presentation, we will have 10 to 12 minutes for Q&A. To ask a question, dial *6. Then, when prompted, press 1 to be added to the queue. When it is your turn, you will be notified that you are unmuted and you may ask your question. We are sure that there will be plenty of questions, and we want to make sure we cover as much information as possible. To that end, we ask that everyone make their questions as concise as possible and refrain from making long statements. And so, on with our program. First, we will hear from Dr. Mark Jacobson, who will update us on the status of the TEPCO. Dr. Jacobson was the first internationally recognized energy expert to issue a detailed response to calls by some climate scientists for the promotion of nuclear power in the Paris Climate Agreement. In response to a call from a friend, Dr. Jacobson also launched the Solutions Project, a broad brush look at all 50 states showing that safe, renewable energy potential is present across the nation. Next, we will hear from Dr. Arjun Makajani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Dr. Makajani has been involved in the clean energy revolution in the U.S. almost from day one, authoring the first study of the energy efficiency potential in the U.S. economy in the 1970s. And in 2007, he published Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a roadmap for U.S. energy policy, the first book showing that renewable energy and efficiency could replace fossil fuels and nuclear power throughout the country. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Jacobson. Dr. Jacobson.
Okay. Thank you for having me on. So I'm going to talk about not only trying to compare nuclear power with clean renewable energy, but also a little bit on our clean energy plans. I mean, I'm motivated by looking at the best solutions to global warming, air pollution, mortality reduction, and energy security. And so it was actually back in 2009 that they did an evaluation comparing different proposed solutions to these problems. And at the time, you know, the major proposed solutions, aside from the renewables like wind and water and solar power, were nuclear power, coal with carbon capture and sequestration, biofuels, for example, and to some extent natural gas. So I tried to look at just compare agnostically those different energy technologies, looking at their environmental impacts and other impacts on reliability, on water supply, on land use, on catastrophic risk, on air pollution, on climate change, and a few other factors. And, you know, when I did this evaluation, I was trying to be straightforward about it, looking at the carbon emissions, for example, and I didn't have an agenda. And what the conclusion was that, well, nuclear was better than some technologies, but it was worse than others. And in particularly, it was not so good as wind, water, and solar technologies for addressing these issues. Just some specifics on this were, in terms of global warming relevant emissions, carbon equivalent emissions, there had been two meta-studies at the time that in 2007 and 2008 that had looked at over 100 peer-reviewed and other types of papers on nuclear life cycle emissions of carbon, and they found between the two of them, one was a mean of 65 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, and the other was 66. And these were two large studies. And that was just the emissions from the life cycle. So most of that's due to uranium refining, for example, but also due to the building of the plants and operating them over their life. But this was, in comparison, was the nuclear energy industry had put out a number around 9 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. But on top of that, what I had found was, well, it takes so long to put up a nuclear power plant, from planning to operation, it's on the order, on average, in fact, for pretty much all plants worldwide between 10 and 19 years, and that's due to the fact that you have to find a location, it has to be vetted, you have to apply for permits, and the permits have to be issued. Those take time, and then the construction time is, you know, on top of that, is about 4 to 9 years, and it could be longer in some cases, but the whole process is around 10 to 19 years. And meanwhile, for a wind or solar farm, for example, it takes 2 to 5 years. And so the difference in time which between the planning and operation of a nuclear plant versus a wind or solar farm, for example, that time while you're waiting around for the nuclear to be put up, the extra time you're running the regular electric power grid, and so you have to account for emissions there. And those emissions are on the order of between 60 and 110 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. So when you add up the two, you get a range that's much that's larger than even the life cycle emissions, and up to at the high end, much higher. And so when you compare it to wind, which is on the order of anywhere from 7 to 10 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, we find that you get 6 to 24 times more CO2 per kilowatt hour from nuclear power than wind. So whereas you hear that nuclear is carbon-free and it's zero carbon, which is not true. In fact, we do get you know, up to 180 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour in comparison at the high end, and at the low end around 70 to 75 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour compared to wind energy, which is anywhere from, you know, up to 10 at the highest. And this is just one issue. There's air pollution associated with those CO2 emissions as well, because you're burning things, and so you have air pollution mortality associated with that. The delays are real delays that slow down the transformation of energy. But those aren't the only issues. I mean, then we had 5 countries of the world had secretly developed nuclear weapons capabilities under the guise of civilian nuclear energy programs. So there's nuclear weapons proliferation issues. There's nuclear meltdown issues. 1.5% of all nuclear reactors ever built to date have melted down to some degree, which is a pretty high failure rate. There's waste issues. There's the uranium mining issues. Now, I'm not the only one who says this. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says there is robust evidence and high agreement to the following problems associated with nuclear. There are operational risks. This is, I'm quoting, operational risks and associated safety concerns, uranium mining risks, financial and regulatory risks, unresolved waste management issues, nuclear weapons proliferation concerns, and adverse public opinion, robust evidence, high agreement. And this is from IPCC 2014 in the executive summary, page 517, if anybody's interested. So this is not news to most of the world, but it's kind of swept under the rug. Those are problems, and for me, the main issues are this weapons proliferation issue, because, you know, if we want to power the world with nuclear, if we wanted to power the entire world with nuclear, for example, we would need 16,000 large, like 850 megawatt or larger, nuclear power plants, and we have 400 in the world today. Now, Jim Hansen had proposed 4,000 additional nuclear reactors, and so that's just 10 times more weapons proliferation risk, 10 times more meltdown risk, and do we need this? Okay, it's sort of maybe it won't happen. It's possible it won't happen, but the thing is we do have alternatives that, and we've found this because this is what I do for research, and Mark DeLucci and I, who's Mark DeLucci at UC Berkeley, and I and over 60 co-authors in many studies and over 35 peer reviewers of our studies that are anonymous have agreed that there are clean, renewable wind, water, and solar options that do not carry these risks that are possible for changing the energy infrastructure of not only the 50 United States, but we've now looked at 139 countries of the world. And we've looked at transforming the energy infrastructure for all sectors of the energy economy. That's not only electricity, but also transportation, heating, cooling, industry, agriculture, forestry, and fishing. And we find that just by electrifying, because electricity is so much more efficient than combustion, on average over all sectors worldwide, we'd reduce power demand just by electrifying by 32% because of the efficiency of electricity. We can get another 7 or 8% end-use energy efficiency improvements beyond those in a business-as-usual case, so we can go down to like 39 or 40% of energy compared to business as usual by 2050, and we power the rest of that with wind, water, and solar, and we find that we can do that at relatively low cost. We also did a grid integration study for the 50 states in the U.S., or 48 contiguous states, showing that we can keep the grid stable 100% of the time for 6 years, looking at a 30-second time step over 6 years, with these wind, water, solar options and low-cost electricity and heat storage without expensive stationary batteries. We would have batteries in transportation and cars, but the electric power storage would be existing hydroelectric power, existing plus plan for permitting pumped hydro storage and new concentrated solar power with storage. And heat storage would just be in water, ice, and rocks underground. And then we'd also have some hydrogen and demand use and demand response. And we can have a stable grid in that case. The electric power would be about 10.5 cents per kilowatt hour average for this range, which would compare to the fossil fuel cost of about the same. The actual generation cost in wind, water, solar case is less than that in the fossil fuels, but we do need additional storage and transmission that brings the cost about the same. But we do eliminate 17 to 25 cents per kilowatt hour in health and climate costs that fossil fuels are causing. Now, just if you look at the cost of electricity today from wind in the United States, the unsubsidized cost of electricity from wind is now 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's the cheapest form of electricity in the U.S. Utility-scale solar thin film is the second cheapest at about 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Natural gas is about 5.2 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour, and utility-scale silicon PVs is about 5.5 cents per to 8 cents per kilowatt hour, whereas nuclear is around 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour based on Lazard 2015 costs of energy. And so nuclear is literally four times more than wind right now in the U.S., new nuclear versus new wind. And so that means every dollar you're spending on nuclear, you're getting one-fourth the energy as you would with wind, but you're also not getting it for 10 to 19 years. So by the time you put up the next few nuclear plants, the Arctic ice will be gone. And so this really becomes not only an opportunity cost, but it's really damaging to the potential for solving the climate problem, especially because it takes so long to put up nuclear, even if it were carbon-free, which it's not, and even if it didn't have all the other problems, which it does. Which surprises me why climate scientists would actually support the proliferation of more nuclear energy if we want to actually solve the climate crisis, because we need to put up things immediately. And nuclear cannot be planned and operated immediately at any large scale. Some people have referred back to the 1970s in some countries like Sweden that put up a bunch of reactors, but they only count the construction time. They ignore the additional 10 years of planning and permitting time. And when you put that up, you find that actually Iowa wind was planned, permitted, and has gone up actually much faster than even Swedish nuclear power in the 1970s. But for the future, nobody's going to put up 4,000 nuclear reactors. It's just not going to happen. So it becomes an opportunity cost, not only in terms of our wasting our time and resources trying to address the issues and repeat these issues to everybody to educate them about why this is not a good solution, but it's also we could have taken the time and the resource to actually just start deploying existing technology, wind, water, and solar, with low-cost existing types of storage and demand response techniques to actually solve the problem right away. I mean, we see the problem being solved. In California, California has a mandate for 50% clean electricity, wind, water, and solar, and without the nuclear, by 2030, and it's already at 25% wind, water, solar in California. So we're 2016, we're already at halfway to the 2030 goal of 50%. I mean, Iowa is at 30% wind right now, and so is South Dakota. And some other states have mandates, others don't. And some states are further along than others, but we also have to transform all energy sectors. Anyway, I don't want to take up any more time right now, but I just want to conclude by saying we think it's technically and economically feasible to transform this energy infrastructure of the states and countries of the world to entirely clean, renewable wind, water, and solar for all sectors, and at low cost and at high reliability. And this will not only eliminate air pollution and global warming, and worldwide that's 4 to 7 million people die from air pollution each year, that we will eliminate those deaths. That cost in 2050 worldwide is $25 trillion per year worldwide, and global climate costs are about the same. And we would stabilize energy prices, we'd reduce terrorism risk because we'd have more distributed energy, we'd have less international conflict because all the renewables would be locally produced, or at least in a state or country or nearby with nearby transmission. And we'd eliminate 4 billion or reduce the 4 billion people in energy poverty worldwide, including 1.3 billion with no access to energy. So I'll stop there and answer questions later.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Jacobson, for all of that incredible information. So I guess we'll go ahead and hand it over to Dr. Arjun Makajani. Thank you, Dr. Makajani, for joining us.
Thank you, Tim. The Paris Agreement is remarkable for two things. One is that the goal it set is not 2 degrees centigrade limit for warming, but well below 2 degrees. And well below was interpreted in the limit as 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, we already passed the threshold for 1.5 degrees Celsius at 430 ppm carbon equivalent in 2011. So we are now above that, so we will have not only to make our emissions go to zero, but eventually we will have to have our emissions go negative. It's a very tough, very difficult goal, but I don't think we actually have a choice because the effects of 2 degrees Celsius, well, the effect of 1 degree rise above pre-industrial, which is about where we are right now, is already pretty bad. And 2 degrees is estimated to be very horrible. I don't know if you read the New Yorker article about Florida, but I really encourage you to do it, what's going on right now in Florida. So that's one thing. The other remarkable thing, so it's going to be very hard. So we can't mess around, we can't waste money, and we can't waste time. The other remarkable thing is for the first time, all countries, including India and China and African countries, Latin American countries, Indonesia, all countries agreed to do something, essentially all. They didn't say, oh, we didn't create the problem, you solve it first, and then we'll see. Now, the commitments, actual commitments, are pretty weak, and they're voluntary, but they all agreed that they are responsible for contributing to the solution. Part of that was delivery of $100 billion a year to developing countries from the developed countries by the year 2020, and to continue to do so at least that much year after year after 2020. That's going to be hard, but the other side is going to be hard too. How are we going to ensure that this $100 billion is well spent? And that the people who come up with that $100 billion get some bang for their buck. That's where the question about nuclear in developing countries comes in. I took the same Lazard data that Dr. Jacobson was talking about and did some analysis around the memorandum of understanding that the Indian government signed with the French to buy 6 reactors and put them on the west coast south of Bombay, Mumbai. Now, if you look at the lowest cost nuclear and utility scale solar in Lazard's estimate, the difference in cost is about $51 a megawatt hour. If you take that and apply it over the 40-year life of these reactors, each 1,000-megawatt reactor would cost $16 billion more than building solar power plants, not taking into account that solar costs are going down, and this is the cheapest estimated nuclear, and that nuclear costs tend to go up. $16 billion per 1,000 megawatt reactor. Now, these are 1,600 megawatt reactors, so you're give or take building about 10,000 megawatts. So you're talking about $160 billion in wasted money. So I think it's extremely important for there to be a process. And this is a challenge for us, those who are, including those who are focused on climate and, you know, they've been kind of agnostic on nuclear. The thing I'm putting forward for those who are focused on carbon, and it is the most important environmental problem in human history by far, I think we can all agree on that, is that we don't have time, we don't have money, and the 1.5 or even well below 2, whatever, however you interpret, it's going to be extremely difficult. We're already at that threshold of concentration, so we have no time or money to waste. Besides, if money is wasted, then the rest of the money may not be forthcoming. It's going to be difficult enough as it is. So I think those who are working worldwide, including in this country, to set an example, we can't afford to be pursuing technologies that cost twice as much and give you much less bang for the buck. I really like Mark Jacobson's calculation about the opportunity cost, how long you have to wait before that nuclear power plant comes online. It's a very good calculation. And I think, so my suggestion has been that we have a process in which the public is involved in creating these energy plans. For India, for instance, I've suggested village-level utilities led by and run by women who are trained to manage them. They already do the water, they do the wood, and so village-level utilities would be responsible for water, sanitation, and energy. And that $100 billion should be directed to them. And, you know, the existing grid can be reorganized to support village-level and small-town-level utilities, which automatically become sort of like microgrids and much more resilient than what we have today. The short of it is, you know, there are lots of other downsides to nuclear. I'm doing a roadmap for Renewable Maryland, just closer to home, to mention something. By far the largest single consumptive use of water in the Susquehanna River Basin is thermal energy generation, including the one Three Mile Island reactor, which is still operating, lots of coal-fired and nuclear plants along that river. Not only does it use a huge amount of water, that river feeds into the Chesapeake Bay, which requires a certain amount of fresh water for its health, and it's not very healthy right now. And we've spent billions of dollars trying to restore it to health. Many jobs are dependent on it. By going to solar and wind energy, we would eliminate the largest consumptive use of water in the Susquehanna River Basin. I think it's about two-thirds of the total consumptive uses of water. And improve the health of the bay. Moreover, there are two things it's very important to consider. High use of water makes nuclear and coal not resilient to extremes of climate. And nuclear is not resilient in one other way. If you know a hurricane is coming and you're going to lose off-site power, it is prudent to shut the power plant down in advance. So as opposed to a microgrid of solar with a battery where, you know, after the Fukushima, I'll close with this example. The contrast between nuclear and a solar microgrid is very clear already. You have to shut down your nuclear plant before extreme weather or a disaster like a tsunami strikes you. If you don't, you could wind up in the kind of situation that Fukushima actually did. If your defenses are overwhelmed, your nuclear plant defenses are overwhelmed. In contrast, in a university there, at the Tohoku Fukushi University, there was an experimental microgrid that had been operating since 2005. It had a gas engine, natural gas engine, a solar installation, and a battery. It was the only electrical plant that was operating after the tsunami hit because the grid was wiped out. Not only that, the natural gas pipeline was wiped out. So the only thing that kept the lights going and people stopped people from being stuck in elevators and kind of provided support to the community was the solar and the battery. We need to go to distributed grids, not only because that makes sense right now with the technology we have in general, but because it is a very necessary preparation for climate change. Nuclear is everything we don't need. It's costly, it takes too long, and then not to talk about making plutonium just to boil water. Thank you. I wanted to give a couple of minutes to Ramana, my friend. I asked him to from Princeton, who I asked him to be on the line and kindly agreed to make a couple of remarks about India and China.
That's right. We are lucky enough to have Dr. M.V. Ramana from Princeton. Dr. Ramana, are you on the phone?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can very clearly. Thank you.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add a couple of very brief points to this very rich discussion we've already had. So I'm not going to take too much time. I wanted to start by saying that the first thing to remember when people are talking about nuclear power being a solution to climate change is that it's not just a matter of building more nuclear power plants, but nuclear power growing as a share of the electricity supply, right? So it's not just that you have to build a few new plants, but that nuclear has to grow in order to so that you can shut down other fossil fuel plants. If you look at the trend, nuclear power has been losing market share almost continuously since the mid-1990s. The highest nuclear power has been as a share of global electricity generation is about 17.6% in 1996. It's been declining steadily, and it is about 11% today. Even the most optimistic forecasts, including by the International Atomic Energy Agency, one of whose mandates is to sort of promote the generation of nuclear energy, only envisions nuclear power sort of maintaining market share. It's their optimistic forecasts are that nuclear power would be something like 11.3% in 2030, and their lower projections come down. And it's even the projections are even worse in terms of market share by 2050. The second point to note is that there's a lot of discussion about, well, nuclear power plants are not growing in the West, but India and China are building large numbers of plants. The thing to note are two things there. First is that these countries have very low shares of nuclear power right now. China is about 2.3%. India is a little higher than that. And these numbers have been pretty much at that level for more than two decades at this point. And they're not likely to grow very significantly. That's because both India and China are building not just nuclear power plants, but also every other kind of power generation that they can think of. So, for example, between 2005 and 2015, so the last decade, China built its capacity of nuclear power went up by about three times, roughly speaking. But during the same period, its installed capacity of wind power went up by 90 times, and its installed capacity of solar power went up by 400 times. And of course, they're supposed to be building coal plants and hydro plants and so on and so forth. So as a share of electricity, even in India and China, nuclear power is not going to expand very much. So to think about nuclear power as being a climate solution is completely ignoring the trend that we have seen so far. And I'll just stop there. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ramana. So I think we'll move on to the Q&A section of the briefing. And just as a reminder to everyone, You can dial in to ask your question by pressing star 6, and then when prompted, press 1, and you'll be added to the question queue. And then when it's your turn, you'll be notified that you are unmuted and you can ask your question. And we already have a couple of people lining up in the queue, and so we'll go ahead and begin have people ask their questions. I think I wanted to pose one question to Dr. Jacobson to kind of kick off and give people time to start dialing in their questions. Dr. Jacobson, you mentioned a couple of really sort of interesting statistics in your presentation, and one was that the amount of nuclear reactors that would be required to provide a very large percent of the global energy supply was on the order of, I think you said 4,000 to 16,000 reactors. And I guess I wondered, in your assessment of the feasibility of deploying nuclear power as a solution to climate change, how that would rate compared to what you've seen as the ability to deploy, renewable energy resources like wind and solar and efficiency.
Sure. Just to clarify the numbers, to power the whole world in all sectors, we would in 2050 we would need about 16,000 850 megawatt plants, and the 4,000 was what Jim Henson was proposing, and I don't know what he was planning for the rest of the energy. He may have just been looking at the electricity sector, but electricity is only 1/4 to 1/5 of total energy, so we're thinking of transforming all energy sectors to electricity and then powering them with wind, water, and solar. We've done the numbers, and we've looked at the land areas required for wind, water, and solar, and we need the numbers are such that, for example, we would need 2 million wind turbines to power for 2 million wind turbines, so 2.5 million wind turbines to power about, I think it was like 35% of all the world's energy, and then a lot of the rest of it would be solar, and it would be a combination of rooftop and power plant solar. But just to get an idea of the land areas required would be, we define land as footprint versus spacing. So the footprint is the actual physical land on the grounds needed. That would be new land. So that does not include rooftops for solar. And so about 15% of the energy you can get from rooftop solar. So that's not new land. But we would need power plant solar and for CSP and PV. And that would take about 0.3% of the world's land. And then for the wind, the spacing between the wind turbines, because there's some of that wind's onshore and most is onshore and maybe a third is offshore. And that wind would take about 0.6% of the world's land for spacing, but that land can be used for agriculture or rangeland, farmland, open space, or it could be co-located with solar, as some plants are done right now. So the total land area is about 1% of the world's land to repower the entire world for all purposes. And 20% of the world's land is used for agriculture, so 1% of the land used for clean renewable energy to power everything and eliminate 4 to 7 million deaths per year does not seem like a huge sacrifice, especially when 2/3 of that land can be used for multiple purposes. So anyway, I have more numbers if you want, but that might be enough for now.
Sure, no, that's very helpful. So we'll begin going to our audience for questions, and I think we'll go with our first questioner is Ms. Skopik from New York City.
Thank you very much, Tim, Dr. Jacobson, and all of you. My question is this: as the world's present nuclear power plants are aging, there seems to be a move, at least here in our country, to relicense or kind of patch them up and keep them going. What do you recommend we do to direct any monies to do that into renewable energy instead so that we prevent relicensing of aging, dangerous power plants?
Well, I don't know who wants. There are two separate questions there. There's the relicensing question, which is the province of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, an arm of the federal government. And then there's the question of the money it takes to run these plants. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission essentially has become a machine for saying yes to the nuclear industry since the mid-1990s, much more so than in the 15 years before that. And so there's very little leverage in stopping the relicensing of these plants. They're actually planning to relicense them for a further 20 years beyond 60 to 80. However, the other process, which is more promising, is many of these plants are now old and require investment and replacement of parts, and they're no longer economical, like some reactors in New York and in Illinois. And the companies that operate them, Exelon, for example, want more money than they can get in the marketplace. That is the time to exercise political pressure at the state level and the Public Service Commission, and to some extent at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to prevent them from changing the rules and fixing them to help nuclear power plants stay online. Because that's an economic question. It's not a Nuclear Regulatory Commission question. That's much harder. I've worked in that arena with Tim and Diane Curran and many people to try to stop these things. It's been very, very difficult and very expensive and generally not successful.
And I'll just add a couple things. First, France is actually mandated to go down from 76% nuclear in their electric grid to 50% by 2025. So they're actually planning to phase down nuclear. Sweden is also, I believe, going to phase down their nuclear. In the United States, I think there's an issue, like for Diablo Canyon, I think is up for it needs repairs or to. And the thing I fear here is if there is a kind of refurbishment, the plant has to be down for a while. So when it's down, you're emitting all from the regular electric power grid, and then you're spending who knows how much to refurbish it. So if instead of it, then it becomes an opportunity cost again, if you took that same money and just invested it immediately in clean renewable wind and solar, that can then last for a lot longer in the long run, and there's likely less downtime, although maybe it's equivalent because you still have to plan and permit, but there are a lot of proposed wind farms and solar farms that are ready to go already and that have already gone through a lot of the permitting. So if those funds could be redirected, then it's a lot more efficient. So I think it becomes an opportunity cost, especially if it's going to cost on the order of hundreds of millions to billions to refurbish, and if they're going to be down for some years before they're refurbished.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Jacobson. So we'll go to our next questioner. Looks like it's someone from the Boston area.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for the presentation. I have two questions. I recall hearing that in case of hydropower, as you flood the areas, that methane comes up from the flooded soil. That's number one. And number two, that the materials necessary for the magnets, I believe, on the windmills are in limited supply, and that would be a limitation then. Can you answer that?
Sure. I assume that's directed at me. First, with regard to dams, well, we have, in our plans for 139 countries, we have zero new dams proposed for conventional hydroelectric power. We do have proposals for pumped hydro, which requires a low and a high reservoir, but it's not the same scale of reservoir as nearly as a conventional hydro. So whatever is occurring right now, it would just occur, but we would not grow that. We would not grow any new dams. Second, it's mostly tropical forest dams that have methane issues. As you go to higher latitudes where temperatures are lower, that's much less of an issue. Especially as you go towards northern U.S. and Canada and Alaska, especially. And there's a lot of uncertainty because there are very few measurements. I mean, there are measurements in some places, but the measurements that where there have been high methane have been mostly tropical dams, and it's usually near the shoreline, so it's hard to extrapolate across all the whole reservoir. And you know, reservoirs are also sinks for methane as well because they're methanogenic. Well, they're not only methanogenic bacteria, but they're methanotrophic bacteria that suck up methane. And so, it's more complex than meets the eye. And because even though the atmospheric lifetime of methane is 8 to 12 years from its oxidation by reaction with OH. Its overall lifetime in the atmosphere is actually a few years shorter because the biggest uptake is by methanotrophic bacteria that are prevalent worldwide too. So it's a little more complicated than it's. Then with regard to the permanent magnets, yeah, you do need neodymium, which is a rare earth element. But we did a calculation that even for 4 million 5 megawatt wind turbines, which we don't even think we need 4 million now. Rather, we might need 2.5, that would only use up about 1/7 of the known supplies of neodymium. And that's just the known supplies, and generally when people start looking for the rare earth, they find it, because rare earths are not actually that rare. It's just that people haven't really looked around for them for very long. So in that case, it's actually there's no limitation since we're not even close to using the amount that we know that exists.
And Dr. Markajani, would you have anything to add to that as well?
Well, the one thing I would add is that I think as we go forward to a renewable energy system, I try not to use the word sustainable if I'm only talking about energy, because I am very aware that there are upstream impacts. You know, with nuclear, of course, we all know about the upstream impacts with uranium mining and so on. But there are upstream impacts to everything. There are upstream impacts to solar panel manufacture, to wind turbine manufacture, to metal, to the enormous amount of copper we need just to run an electrical system. And we're going to need more because, I agree, we need to electrify things. One of the things I'm developing in the Renewable Maryland project is to set forth sustainability criteria that are beyond renewable and clean energy that go to the question of mining. And I think we do have to build in the recycling and recovery of these materials. One of the mistakes that we made with compact fluorescents is to not remember that there's mercury in them. And a system for the recovery of mercury and the costs of that should have been built into the production of compact fluorescents. So I think if, you know, our dumps from 100 years of dumping things may be very important mines of the future. We can clean up the mess we've made and get mines. We haven't yet properly thought through the sustainability of whole energy systems. And then my other point would be is that we do have to have a notion of enough. It's very clear that in India, the vast majority of people don't have enough. But so far as the flow of materials in American society is concerned, I think the flow of materials is enough. We're just not doing a very good job of using them effectively. But we need to develop complementary notions if we're going to succeed in having a sustainable system, not only for energy, but for the materials that support our lives.
Thanks, Dr. Markajani. So we'll go on to the next question. This is from a 734 area code.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, this is David Schoenberger from Michigan.
Thanks, Dave.
Yes, so to Dr. Jacobson, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission claims that no states or utilities to date operate arrays of wind installations as virtual power plants, meaning interconnected wind installations separated by long distances that would function as a baseload power generator. So in your paradigm, the concept of baseload is obsolete. And so I guess the question is, what needs to, what's the disconnect here in where the NRC is coming from compared to where you're coming from?
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good question. I think they're assuming that we do need base load, and nuclear generally serves as base load, as a type of base load power. And so,
and Dr. Jacobson, can you explain that concept a little bit for folks who aren't aware of it?
Well, yeah, so base load is, in theory, it's just having a flat supply of energy that's constant day and night, 24/7, 365 days a year. And so, power demand is variable. It goes up and down with by hour, by minute, by second. But there is usually some low level that there's always some minimum power demand. So anything below the minimum could be satisfied by a baseload constant power supply. But to get that peak, to get the peaks in the demand, traditionally what is needed, or today what's used, is either hydroelectric power or natural gas on peaker plants. But I should point out that natural gas peaker plants, the energy cost of a peaker, to run a peaker plant, is on the order of 16 to 20 cents per kilowatt hour, whereas conventional natural gas, when it's used as base load, it just, when it's all on, in other words, is closer to 5 to 5.5 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour. But the peakers are actually much larger. Hydroelectric, though, is actually probably the cheapest form of peaking, because it runs basically, all you have to do is you can flip a switch and within seconds you can get the water coming down and run a turbine. And that's usually around 4 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour when run as peaker or not. But hydro can also be run as baseload. But in our paradigm, so nuclear industry thinks, and they claim, and same to coal people would say the same thing, and the gas people would say the same thing. Well, because wind and solar are so variable and intermittent and random, effectively, although they aren't random, but they are, very intermittent and irregular. They say that, we can't keep the grid stable. But the fact is, we do keep the grid stable with a variable intermittent power demand. And we do it by turning on these peaker plants or hydro. But it turns out that, when you electrify all the sectors, when you electrify all the energy sectors, then it actually makes it easier to match power demand, because there are all sorts of tools that can be used to match power demand. And one is called demand response, where a utility will give an incentive to, let's say, a wastewater treatment plant not to use power at 4 in the afternoon. Instead, the wastewater treatment plant can run at night. Another example is, if you have an electric car, you don't need the wind turbine connected to your car to run an electric car. You can provide the electricity to your batteries pretty much any time of day or night. So the utility can give an incentive to a car user to charge when electricity costs are low and demand is low, such as at night, and that's usually when it's convenient too. Same thing with heating. Most electricity use for air conditioning is in the afternoon, or late afternoon, when the temperature is high in the summer. And so my university at Stanford, since 1998, they've had an ice cube under a building. And so at night, when electricity price is low, they create ice. And then in the day, instead of using electricity for air conditioning at the peak time, they just melt the ice, which is a lot more energy efficient, and use that for cooling. And so that's a way to actually use heating storage, heating or cooling storage, to shift the time of peak load. So you can do shifting of time of peak load when you have, for heating and cooling and for demand. But it also turns out that wind and solar are very complementary in nature. So when the wind is not blowing, the sun is usually shining during the day, and vice versa. So you can actually smooth out demand by interconnecting wind and solar farms. And the same thing, even if you have wind farms that are far apart, when you put them on the grid, you know, when wind is not blowing in one place, it's usually blowing somewhere else. In fact, there was another study that came out just last week from NOAA that showed that if you interconnect the United States with high voltage direct current, you can grow up to 80% wind and solar alone without any storage and match the power demand, just because you can always get some power somewhere in the U.S. Because the wind is blowing somewhere and the sun is shining somewhere during the day. And you can actually get, you know, up to 80% without any storage. But we showed that you can get up to 100% with low-cost storage of both heating, cooling, and electric power storage when you electrify all sectors and you use demand response, and you can use some hydrogen too, because hydrogen is a form of storage. When you have too much wind or too much solar, you can use the excess to create hydrogen, and that can be then used for transportation or some industrial processes as well. So it's really just optimization with a different paradigm, a different system than compared to today. So the nuclear industry is just thinking very narrowly with blinders, saying, you know, this is what we have today. If we just shut all the nuclear off and we try to use wind and solar, it'll be hard to match the demand. Well, that might be true, but you can use existing technologies and, as I mentioned, demand response, hydrogen, electrifying other sectors, and you can actually solve this problem. It's just an optimization problem, and there have been several studies now that have shown that you can do it pretty effectively.
Great. So we are coming up upon 9 o'clock, and I think we have the ability to go a little longer, but I wanted to check in with Dr. Jacobson to see if you had any extra time to spend with us tonight.
Yeah, actually, I can spend a little more time now.
Okay, great. So in the interest of getting through as many of the questions as we can, we do have a number of people in the queue, why don't we go on to our next caller? This is from an 845 area code.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. It's Manager Green from Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. First of all, this is really excellent, and I'm hoping that it has been recorded or some of the presentations are written so that we can share them widely.
Indeed, we are recording the call.
Great. My question is to Dr. Makajani. He quoted some numbers regarding the cost of, I think a specific comparison was nuclear out 40 years and either solar or wind. I was trying to take notes, but it's a little bit scribbly. But my question was whether or not the renewable component included storage.
No. That comparison was on utility scale solar
right.
with the lowest nuclear cost. And the cost difference did not include storage. So we're doing this Renewable Maryland project and finishing up very detailed. You know, it's not simple to get to a renewable energy system. It's complex. It will require a very different grid. It will require significant investments. I think on balance it's going to be less costly or cheaper. It's going to be cheaper than today in terms of fraction of income and going to be cheaper than business as usual, but it's going to be complicated. We have to do a lot of things, including changing our concepts away from baseload and so on. The role of storage, so long as you are in a larger grid, doesn't come in until quite late. We just finished modeling 15 years out for the state of Maryland, which is 8% of the PJM grid. And we found that at 55% renewables, solar and wind, we actually did not need storage. So currently, of course, we have these responsive systems. We have some hydro. We have gas turbines and so on. Eventually, you want to be phasing out gas turbines. We will need storage, I think. Currently, at least, storage is on the expensive side, but costs of batteries are coming down very rapidly. I think this problem will be solved. There's not only cars for storage. We have to electrify a lot of non-road transportation. So a lot of air pollution is caused by lawnmowers, which also and leaf blowers, and you'd be surprised by how important these kind of sectors are in petroleum consumption. But one advantage is when you electrify heating, you tend to get severe demands in the middle of winter nights when the wind has been low and there's no sunshine and you've used up your storage. You can have all your lawnmowers available for demand response throughout the winter. And so we have to be creative. We have to find ways of compensating lawnmower owners for using their batteries, like compensating cars for the use of their batteries. But I think we can get there, and we need to deal with the existing interests. Between 50 and 100% is more complicated than getting between now and 50%.
Great. Thanks, Arjun. And so we'll move on to the next question. This is from an 804 area code.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much, Tim, Nears, and Dr. Jacobson, and Arjun for being there, and everybody else. my question is about dealing with nuclear power plants as it goes for the heat they emit, and I'm wondering if maybe Arjun or someone can give me some information on where I can maybe find data or studies. But obviously, when nuclear power plants are running, they're emitting the steam into the atmosphere. But also, like with my local nuclear plant, North Anna, I mean, it's got 2 million gallons going through that facility every minute. And right now, the lake temperature for discharge water is about 25 degrees hotter. So I'm just wondering.
Right.
If there are some studies where I'd like to show our local officials, because they want to build a third one, on how that is actually detrimental to the environment, especially dealing with the climate issues.
Well, as I mentioned, the use of water in all thermal plants, nuclear plants and coal plants mainly, is a huge issue. Every 1,000 megawatt plants, I think you've got 2,000 megawatts at North Anna, if I'm not, around that, use about 10 to 20 million gallons of water a day by evaporation. At the lower end, it would be like what you have there. You have a cooling pond, you heat up the water, and when you heat it up, of course, it evaporates. You lose some by conduction. You evaporate the most when you have cooling towers, but then you have the smallest intake. You also have quite a lot of water pollution when you have cooling towers. That's one of the downsides, because you add fungicides and you add anti-corrosion chemicals, and all of that, of course, goes into the water. Thermal pollution is a huge issue, and in places like North Anna, where you have I think you have a cooling lake at North Anna. Am I mistaken about that? You have a large, very large lake that supplies cooling water to the reactors there?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
Yeah, so my memory does serve me right. And the larger water bodies are relatively protected. Where you have more thermal pollution issues directly is when you're discharging hotter water directly to rivers or to the ocean. This is now turning to be a very significant problem in Florida. The difficulty with, of course, cooling lakes is that it takes an enormous amount of land. I don't know what it is in North Anna, but I know the South Texas project, which has two reactors like you at North Anna, has a 7,000-acre cooling lake. And I calculated that if you use that 7,000-acre cooling lake, you could probably, now this is from memory, so I shouldn't say the number since it's being recorded, but some fraction of the generation of the nuclear plant could be generated by putting solar panels on that 7,000 acres.
This is Mark. I can give you some numbers. I actually did a paper a couple of years ago on looking at the heat and water vapor emissions from all the energy use worldwide. And so there's a calculation in a table that I have of the, on a worldwide scale, of water vapor emissions just from evaporation for cooling from nuclear. So it was about 5,000 teragrams of water vapor per year. And for the heat, because you have heat of reaction that's emitted, it's about 1,900 terawatt hours per year. And that's, yeah, from nuclear reaction. Anyway, there's a paper. If you want to email me, I can forward you this, a link to the paper.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Jacobson. So we're about 9:07. Do we still want to take some more questions? Is that okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Great. So we have our next one is from a 216 area code.
Yeah, hi. This is Connie Klein from Ohio.
Hi, Connie.
I have a very general question. I'd like to know how these gentlemen, let me preface it by saying that Obama to me has been very much a mixed bag and in some respects a great disappointment. How do these gentlemen propose to get this information to the decision makers so that we can do some real convincing here?
Maybe I'll address this. So I actually have some good news to report. There's actually this, all these, well, at least our 100% studies have gotten to, in the U.S., to several decision makers. California and New York have adopted about 60% of our 2030 plans, so they've adopted 50% clean renewable energy by 2030, and we propose 80% in multiple sectors. And the House of Representatives did the there's a bill, H.R. 540, that was sponsored by, I think, 27 or 29 co-sponsors now, that is based on our 100% U.S. plans to go, for the United States to go 100% renewable energy by 2050. And all three Democrat presidential candidates adopted our 100% goals of 50% of 100% by 2050. And, for example, Senator Sanders has a map of our plans on his website. Senator Clinton has there's a video of her saying she's committed to 100% clean renewable energy and natural. And in fact, she even states that natural gas didn't get in the way of it. And that it's that, you know. But I think, you know, what she says is, or what all the candidates say is maybe different from what they actually do. So, but we have all committed, and O'Malley, who just retired, was also 100% renewable energy. So this has gotten in front of these policymakers. None of the Republicans have taken it on, unfortunately. But it's not too late for them to. And on a world scale, we're trying to get these plans out to the public.
I have a comment about that. The reflecting on the Paris Agreement, sort of my bottom line was that it has good goals, it has universal commitment to do something, but it has no teeth. And the bottom line for me is that we need to take the teeth out of, we need to take the tiger out of Exxon's tank and put it in the Paris Agreement. At present, the main obstacle is not resources, it is not cost, it's not technology. It's basically that those who stand to lose or think they stand to lose a lot, you know, the oil companies, the gas companies of the world, the banks that have loaned them money, they are the utilities who don't want to change their way of doing business, the Exelons that want more money for nuclear reactors that can't compete in the marketplace. That is the main problem. So every politician, when they get into office, are confronted by that reality, despite their promises, or they get into office knowing that reality and don't promise you anything, which would be true of many candidates, or rather promise you more oil and gas drilling. And we're headed to a world where we're going to have to face the question of who pays for these stranded assets, because well below 2 degrees Celsius is going to mean stranded assets. It's also going to mean millions of coal miners who lose their jobs. And for me, I'd rather devote public money to helping those coal miners find work in the new energy economy and give notice to the Exxons of the world that, you know, if they keep on investing in oil, their shareholders are going to have to pay for those stranded assets, not us like last time during electricity deregulation when we wound up paying for the stranded assets.
Great. And so if we have time, I'd like to take another caller. Would that be okay with you, Dr. Jacobson and Dr. Makajani?
Sure, sure.
Yes.
For me, anyway.
Okay, great. So our next caller is from a 360 area code.
Hello, maybe this is a good question to end on. I'm Carolyn Treadway from Lacey, Washington. I wanted to find out if we could have some of this information in writing. The recording is wonderful, but it goes very fast, and it's hard to get the information down, especially the facts and so on that were given in the two speeches, but also any links to articles and things like that from our speakers that they have authored that we could get online. I would appreciate links. Dr. Jacobson said, email me. Well, what's the email? And so on like that, just to be able to make this information more clear to us. Is that possible from NIRS to do?
Great, Carolyn. It's an excellent question. And I guess, well, yes, I'll put it to our presenters. Drs. Jacobson and Makajani, would you be willing to kind of give us some hand-picked studies and resources that we could put on the website along with the recording?
Yeah, no problem. I mean, you know, we have quite a lot of resources. You can download my book, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, for free. I made a presentation to the Royal Commission in South Australia on the question of nuclear energy, and I wrote a paper for that. So many of the arguments that I presented about nuclear today are in that paper, and that's on our website. Our website is ieer.org, and I'll certainly send it to Tim. My blog, of course, is available. There are a couple of studies from Renewable Maryland. There are lots of resources. I'll send a few of the links to Tim to not overwhelm you, but really explore our website. You'll find a lot of resources there. Plutonium, why is plutonium a bad thing? How much has plutonium cost us? And Ramana, of course, works for Princeton and the Fissile Materials Project. They have lots of excellent resources, too. Maybe he will send you some links as well.
Great.
This is Mark. A couple of things. Yeah, you can email me at Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-O-N, at Stanford, like StanfordUniversity.edu. And otherwise, also, if you go to thesolutionsproject.org, thesolutionsproject.org, which is one word, they have a map. If you go down, page down, there's actually a world map and a state map, where you can click on a state and or country and get a basic summary of a plan. On the bottom, I think, of each map, below the map, is a link to the websites that have all the papers that are 139 country plans and are 50 state plans. And there are also links to the comparison I mentioned, the 2009 comparison, but if you want all that information specifically, just email it to me. And I can give you the links directly.
My email, you can email me directly through our website.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. And I guess what I'll do is I'll throw it to you to see if you have any, if you want to conclude with any other remarks to wrap up our conversation.
Mark, you want to go first?
I think I just want to end on a positive note that I think there's, you know, it's possible to transform energy to clean and renewable energy at low cost and with saving, not only saving lives, addressing climate, but we also found you can create jobs in the meantime. So in the U.S., we create a net of 2 million jobs. That's jobs produced minus loss net of 2 million. Worldwide, it's about 22 million by transforming the energy infrastructure of states and countries. And we'd stabilize energy prices as well. We'd eliminate a lot of energy poverty and reduce international conflict by, since we won't have international trade of oil, for example, or gas, for that matter. And land use problems would go down. I mean, one thing about, you know, even though you have to mine for the materials for solar and wind, it's only a one-time mining versus nuclear, for example. You have to continuously mine and refine uranium throughout the life of the nuclear power plant ad infinitum, and then you have to store the waste for 300,000 or 400,000 years. And, you know, it's funny because I saw a picture, somebody showed a picture of a facility where they're temporarily storing nuclear waste, and it's a building that has, like, it's a huge football-sized building with lots of lights, and I'm thinking, okay, were they going to keep the lights on 300,000 years? And, you know, all the energy that's going to be used to store that energy, store that waste. You know, anyway, I just want to conclude by saying it's a, transforming is something that can be very beneficial, will be very beneficial to humanity.
I think, you know, those of us who've looked at it have generally concluded, and it's not just Mark or me or people who are sort of objective numbers folks, but across a broad front, people have concluded that we can do this. Mark cited the NOAA study, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study. So the technical, the economic pieces are all there. I, however, want to alert you that this is not a simple road. I already alluded to that. It's going to be very difficult and conflict-ridden. And I want to throw up a couple of cautions for us because we're going to have to deal with these problems. So low oil prices, I think, actually are a good thing because it shows that oil is becoming obsolete like stones after the Stone Age, and banks are not going to want to invest in new oil, and we want to avoid new oil infrastructure. But if you read yesterday's and today's headlines, Iraq is suffering a great deal. Many countries are becoming destabilized. Russia produces 10 million barrels of oil a day and is a major oil exporter. If they already have very high inflation, we're already in the middle of serious conflict. So some conflicts are around oil exports and oil resources and control of oil resources. In fact, 20th century was largely about conflict over oil resources, not only, but largely. But I think the nature of that conflict might change because people will try to hold on to that. The specter of Russia falling apart with very low oil prices, with thousands of nuclear weapons, not easy. I think this will be thrown upon the kind of conflicts that come with the climate change that we're already experiencing. So I think this transition will be very difficult and complicated. The 1.5 goal is also going to be very difficult. So we need to get on with the technical tasks, which I think are the simpler ones, but require a lot of political will. But I think it will also take a lot of joining hands with the people who work for peace and justice to make sure that we're not entering a world in which new conflicts emerge from the way the old system falls apart. Because the old system needs to fall apart, the old energy system, but it's very tied up with the old military system, too. It's a connection I just want to point out. So I agree with the positive part in terms of being able to do the energy, new energy system. We ought to get on with the job and do it efficiently, but we also ought to prevent new conflict. It's part of our responsibility, I think.
Well, with that really wonderful point and counterpoint to wrap up the conversation, I do want to thank Drs. Mark Jacobson and Arjun Makhijani for this these great presentations and really important information, for the generosity of your time, staying along with us so late tonight, and also want to thank everybody who called in tonight. And I think to this, you know, to the last points that were made, I think what we're really looking at in terms of, you know, the kind of reality versus inertia moment that we're in terms of both the climate crisis and, you know, and the fate of nuclear power. But this is the, you know, this is really what NEERS's role is to help build the social movements and create the social change that are necessary in order for society to make the positive choices that are going to guide us through this, you know, kind of Scylla and Charybdis of the options that are before us. And so with that, I just, you know, want to thank everybody as well for your activism and for your involvement. And also pay attention for the, you know, for the campaigns and the actions that NEERS is going to be engaged in, and to let us know how we can help you in your state and at the local level in engaging these issues and making sure that we navigate ourselves to a carbon-free and nuclear-free energy future in the years to come. So with that, thank you, everyone, and we'll be in touch. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.